This is the Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
Good evening, Power listener. I am joined on the line by Sasha Knox, an economist, Phelisa Nkomo, also an economist, and finally Rach Nkosi, also an economist, to discuss the medium-term budget policy statement from this week. You can join the conversation by calling us on 0861-987-000. You can also tweet us at PowerFM987. And our Twitter hashtag is #PowerPerspective. Good evening, Sasha.
Good evening.
Good evening, Phelisa.
Hi, good evening, Nokanya.
Hi, Reg.
Hi, Lee.
Phelisa, don't out me here by calling you by my other name. I know you always forget to refer to me as Lee.
All right, okay. Good evening, Lee.
Hi. So I wanted to. There has been a lot of analysis that's been done on the medium-term policy statement this week. I just actually wanted us to slow it down a little bit and actually grapple with what is quite obviously a very dire situation for our economy. So this was the 23rd medium-term budget statement and the first of the sixth administration. The finance minister opened his statements by informing us that expenditure continues to exceed revenue and that national debt is actually increasing at scarily and unsustainable levels. He anticipates that it will be about 70% in 2023. Sasha, how did we get here?
So I think something that really stands out for me in this MTBPS is the severity of really regressive economic austerity measures that are being put into place. I mean, you pointed to the fact that the situation is incredibly dire. And I think that's very accurate. You know, there's a 2% cut in goods, services, and capital expenditure projected for each year moving forward. And to put that in context, the IMF has stated that a 1% reduction in government spending would reduce GDP between 0.9% and 1.7%. So that's a really significant impact. And something for me is that, you know, I think that a lot of economists kind of get locked into these ideological battles, you know. Mm. You know, I could say that the economic policies of South Africa have been contradictory to the political policies towards, you know, creating liberated lives. But then I think that we do start to enter that space where it's about those kind of ideological differences. And I think that the problem with that is that that becomes a conversation that really between the people in the room. You know, the majority of people in South Africa can't access what we're actually even talking about in that kind of instance, you know. And I think that what that hides as well is that we're talking about real people and real people's lives. And as you mentioned, the situation is incredibly dire. I mean, our unemployment rates are through the roof, and the amounts of South Africans that live below the food poverty line are 25.5%. So that's a quarter of the South African population that are living in really terrible circumstances.
And Sasha, that number is actually increasing, right? So it's not like we are actually pulling people out of poverty. I think it was about 2 years ago when the former statistician general actually said that from about 2011, the intensity of poverty in South Africa has actually increased.
Mm. I mean, we're the most unequal country in the world, you know, and that's not just a statistic. That's saying that people are living lives of absolute desperation. You know, we hear about the terrible unemployment rate, but actually the expanded unemployment rate, which includes unemployed people who have stopped looking for work for over a year, I mean, that's at close to 40%, you know. So even looking at the failure to kind of redress past imbalances, unemployment amongst Black South Africans is at 43%. That's nearly half. And you know, the stunting levels for children under five go up to 50%. So that's nutritional stunting from children not being able to have a nutritious meal.
And that means
you're
that
asking at the start.
That means that these kids, that means that the stunted kids will not be economic participants in the future. So 30% of our kids already, we know, are going to have a very hard time joining the economy. Pelisa, what was your view of the medium-term budget policy statement this Wednesday?
I mean, good evening, colleagues, and good evening to the listeners. I mean, I think it's such a vague document, actually. From a number of fronts, and I think I'm just going to make one point. In fact, to just reflect that it's a vague document. I don't really believe sometimes in the capital market's reaction. But I think the fact that just an hour after the Minister of Finance had announced the budget, the rand had just lost its financial value by 3 or 4%. And I think for me, that was an indication that actually we've not been able to address the real issues we're confronted with. I think obviously this was followed by the following day around the Moody's, that downgrade. So I think it's a very important indicator.
Sorry, Moody's didn't downgrade us. Did they not just change the outlook to negative?
Right. Yes, no, but I mean, still, they still put us on a BEBAA3, right?
Mm-hmm.
And saying, we are actually watching you. Exactly. Mm-hmm. What are you going to plan to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, I mean, and I think for me, I think the point I want to make still, the two reactions from the market is not in really a yardstick that fundamentally you use to actually see. But I also know that because we've made choices around our own economic posture, and consistently we've always been looking at the market's reaction in every time we actually announce medium budget statements. So it means that, and I think it underscores the point that it was vague. So there are several things as well I want to make around that. I think the Minister of Finance, I don't think they actually know what they're supposed to be doing with regards to our economy. I think Sasha makes the point, for example, around the issue of increased unemployment just on the eve of the medium-term budget. Of 29.1%. So you would expect that one of the key issues that the statement should really be addressing is to what are the areas where we need to create decent employment opportunities, targeting young people, targeting people from the township, but also what sectors that remain strategic for the economy to be able to address. Yes, of course, from a social justice perspective, people will be happy when you hear that the priority for the medium-term budget was on education, was on social development, and was on and healthcare, right? But of course, it remains a concern because the reality is that part of ensuring that your citizens remain productive and they live a life and they enjoy their rights that are enshrined in the Constitution, that fundamentally they must be able to have access to economic opportunities. So you give, if citizens have access to good healthcare, that's great. If they have access to social development services, that's excellent. If they have access to good education, that's excellent. Then what do they do after that, right? So you would expect, for example, that one of the key things that the medium-term budget should also be addressing is a reallocation of funding for industrial development. Over the years, I mean, funding for industrial development has been sitting between 1.2% to 0.6%, a strong indicator that this is not an area, the industrial development is not an area that we place a lot of priority into it.
Which is a problem, given the fact that we've actually got constrained aggregate demand in the economy. So the government is not doing anything to actually stimulate that.
Yes, in fact, absolutely. For example, the contradiction around the public wage bill versus the issues of demand. And I think let me just attend to that for a second.
Mm.
One of the key things as an economist to understand is that government is always an employer of the last resort when the economy is shrinking. So what then you need to do, you need to be able to spend in the economy to stimulate the demand in the economy. So the minister makes an interesting point that he was hoping that when in February he was making an announcement for civil servants who are interested in taking early severance or early retirement, that option will be taken up. But also it actually reflects the fact that a lot of civil servants, and I'll say this very specifically, are Black people, are women, are people from the working class communities.
And they also earn below, the vast majority of them actually earn below 15,000 rand a month. So we are saying that our public sector wage bill is actually inflated without understanding exactly where the job sits in the public sector, because a lot of these people are frontline service people.
Yes.
So if you do away with them, how does that then impact on service delivery?
In fact, absolutely. In fact, fundamentally, it just undermines the notion of developing a developmental state, because the issue is that while it's important to look on rand and cents around public sector wage bill, but at the same time, it's important to actually understand what type of state you want to create and how you would like citizens to interact with that state. And at the heart of it is the public servants that you actually need for them to deliver a good quality service to the public sector. So if you want to cut because you're worried about rent and cents argument, I mean, I think for me it's contradictory in terms. I think the point that Sasha makes, which I agree with her, is how you see a very clear political agenda in terms of where you want to take the economy versus what the state actually delivers to its citizens.
Okay. So sorry, Pelisa, I just want to bring Reg in here. Reg, what was your take on the medium-term budget policy statement?
Thanks. Good evening again. I think the minister is correct. South Africa is in dire straits. There's no doubt about that. But I think, again, it is true that if economists have been following what we have been doing as a country for quite a number of years, we shouldn't be surprised to find ourselves in the situation where we are. It seems to me, though, that the minister does not seem to understand that our very policies are the ones that are sinking us.
Mm.
His very action, including the actions that he did or what he's going to be doing going forward, will continue to sink us.
And here, Rach, are you speaking about the austerity measures? Because I just want to link it up to something that Sasha said. She said that every percentage point in terms of budget cuts will cost us between 0.9% and 1.7% of the economy. Now, we know that in this policy statement, somewhere in there is a 5% cut in terms of government spending. Now, that is an economy that's going to shrink about 5% where we're not growing already.
Absolutely. Austerity, austerity, austerity. According to the minister or the Treasury as a whole, including the Reserve Bank, they think that by cutting wages, by cutting expenditures, that way you reduce debt, that way you grow the economy. That's strange economics, very, very strange macroeconomics. And they continue to do the same. But also what's funny is, instead of the minister saying, giving us a sense as to what our real problems are, you know, and how we are going to deal with these problems, he just doesn't. You know, he just said, well, you know, the actual problem is that we are spending above our revenue. Frankly, that's not it, you know?
Actually, what he said was expenditure continues to exceed revenue and national debt is increasing at an unsustainable pace. Now, that worries me because, first and foremost, it indicates a misunderstanding from the minister in terms of the role of fiscal policy and monetary policy in terms of dealing with these things. Sasha, what was your sense in terms of are we doing the right things to stimulate the economy?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with some of what the other speakers have said. You know, you started by asking me, like, why did we end up here? You know, and I think the severity of the situation really does need to be emphasized, but it's also due to years of cutbacks and years of implementing these policies. And really what we're starting to see is the proof that these policies don't work. In fact, they make things increasingly worse. You know, and I was saying, like, we shouldn't necessarily have ideological debates because this is about people's lives, you know. And I think that with the evidence, like, if we are talking about people's lives, then we need to look at the evidence. And the evidence across the world is saying that these policies don't work. It's actually, like, massive waves of popular revolt at the moment and global waves of protest where we see the general failure of the dominant economic model, you know. So there's protests in Tunisia, Algeria, Sudan, Chile, Argentina, Barcelona, Hong Kong. You know, South Africa could be really critically positioned to choose policies that really make a difference to people's lives and improve the economy, you know. So we know that the situation is dire. We know that we have to make difficult decisions. But why then do we choose the difficult decision that's about cuts, which directly affect service delivery and disproportionately affect the most vulnerable, you know. Yeah. So that's black women, people living in poverty, migrants, people with disabilities, gender nonconforming people. You know, we have an obligation to redress some of the inequalities and discrimination of our past, and we're completely failing in that duty. You know, I want to raise the fact that we've just had this moment of national euphoria around, you know, winning the World Cup. And I think that that's fine if that becomes about what we're capable of doing as a country, you know, rather than about masking the difficult realities of people living in this country, you know. Sometimes we have to look the scary thing in the face to know that we have to change it, you know, and make real, you know, the aspirations for equality. So what we see is that there's no credible evidence that a particular level of debt is growth suppressing. But what we do know is that public sector cuts do incredible damage. And it also does damage to the economy because, as some of the other speakers have said, when the economy is stagnating, which is happening all over the world right now, you know, so the Moody's putting us on a negative outlook is absolutely to be expected in the global context, you know. But
Sasha, I do want to talk about that. So Pelisa, there's an anticipated 0.8% contraction in the world economy this year. Now, South Africa's growth is already constrained, okay? Mm. What does this mean for us? Just tagging on to what Sasha was saying, what does this global contraction in growth actually mean for the lives in South Africa?
Well, I mean, it's actually come worse. In fact, I just want to make 2 points from what Sasha is talking about around an acceptable level of a debt to GDP ratio, because I think there's just so much alarmist around it, right? I think the first
let's start by positioning it. Our current debt to GDP ratio sits just below 60%. The finance minister indicated that it would be just over 70% come 2023. Mm-hmm. So that means that our debt relative to how much the economy makes will be 70%, which if you were to compare it to households, which I'm very loath to do, is very much where a lot of our households sit, actually, where you're spending 70% of your money even before it comes in.
Absolutely. So that's a very, yes, I mean, thank you for grounding that, the point. But the issue here is that, so the assumption that if you reduce the debt to GDP, which in fact, that's what the minister anticipates in the medium-term statement, they anticipate that by 2022, it will increase to 71.3%. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there will be cutting, right, in terms of the current expenditure, capital expenditure, right, capital formation expenditure, as well as the transfers either to provinces, to local government, or the special conditional grants, right? Yes. Now, and fundamentally, in an economy that is constrained, and I mean, they'll be cutting almost about 200 billion. So in an economy that is constrained already with demand, and the state that is meant to actually stimulate the economy, I don't think the national treasurer, including, I mean, the whole government, has thought it through around both the economic impact, but as well as the social impact. So I want to highlight several issues. I think already, between 2017 and to date, we've been growing at less than 2%, right?
Mm-hmm.
We've had about more than 3,800 companies that have applied for rescue in the manufacturing sector, and jobs are lost already, right? That's the first issue. And so it means that you're losing the revenue, the tax revenue that you require. And in the medium-term budget, they're already saying we won't be able to collect the revenue that we require at almost 4%. Now, that's the first point. And then the second issue I want to make is that it means that a lot of families who are currently depend on the social security system will just go back to social security system, right? So you're expecting even more people to go into the net. Currently, we provide 17 million South Africans, both the elderly, the children, and those who are disabled. Yes. So the likelihood that the numbers are actually going to increase, because in essence, if you use the means testing system, it means that people are those who actually are likely to lose jobs now from. Remember, we've lost in the two quarters already, we've lost about 2.1%, right? So those people are likely to go back to start queuing up into the social development, saying we have no income, but we have children. So can you please come back into the system? So the social impacts are going to be very dire. I think the issue as well, it's going to be around, because there's a huge issue about the impact of gender-based violence linked with access to economic opportunities. Mm-hmm. And we're likely to see a rise of that, right? In particularly without a very clear and a concrete plan in relation to that. Now, I know over the years, one of the key things that the government has really been doing, it's the failure to introduce structural reforms. When I'm saying I mean structural, but fundamentally, at a microeconomic level, sectoral level, right, has always been subsidized by access to social wage, right? So it's either it's cash transfer, or it's access to an RDP house, it's access to free electricity, it's access to water. And because we've always de-linked the argument within in our own national economic narrative, so consistent is always, no, you know, the working class and the poor are actually safe. And the reality is they're actually not, because the more they come into, the more they are unable to be economically active, obviously, what they then do is that they go straight into the social protection system and they sit there for support. And if the state is not able to actually collect sufficient revenue to provide a safety net for the poor, you're actually going to sit with social instability, which already we've been going through. So
okay.
I mean, I think the National Treasury and government must really go back into the drawing board and really start thinking through around what are the key things that really need to be done to activate the South African economy. And I don't want to be ahead of myself. I think it's a question I'm going to be asking us a little bit later, but I do think that it's really important that we start thinking about at a microeconomic level, what are the things that we've done, and at a sectoral level, what are the things that we need to do to be able to push for structural reforms.
So, Rich, what is the impact of austerity? I mean, Pelisa has pointed a very stark picture in terms of the fact that austerity is going to mean that more and more people go into the social security net without a rise in revenue from a government perspective. This situation actually becomes quite dangerous from a political stability perspective. What is your view on what the impact of austerity is going to be?
It's going to be very dire, absolutely dire. But before I get to that, let me just quickly connect up to the global situation which you talked about earlier. There's a synchronized slow growth globally.
Yes.
As writers put it. There's no doubt that's going to affect us and is affecting us. Therefore, what you call revenue will be going down. I don't like the word revenue. Will be going down. And virtually all key macroeconomic indicators will be heading south. Now, austerity, which perhaps is not a very good word to use. It is about cutting expenditure and raising taxes. Both of them liquidate the economy, okay, further down. Mm. So effectively, what that means is that the debt that we have right now, instead of coming down, will actually be going up. When that debt goes up, the interest payment will obviously go up. A range of other macroeconomic indicators will also be worsening as a consequence of this act of fiscal consolidation. Well, why South Africa or many countries use it is because their understanding of macroeconomics is not particularly good. They assume the government finances are exactly, or they operate exactly the way household or firm finances operate. They think that a person like you and me go to work and pick up salary of 20,000 per month, for example, and we cannot spend more than that. You know, if we do, that means we're in trouble.
But Rich, there's a fundamental flaw in that kind of thinking, and I kind of want us to deal with it now, is that governments fundamentally aren't like households, because unlike households, governments have the ability to actually create money.
Precisely.
So it's a misnomer to say that a government's finances should be looked at like a household's finances, because in my house I can't create money, but government can. So government can actually spend its way out of debts.
It can, yes.
May I jump in?
Oh, sorry. Okay. Can just Rich just finish his point, then I'll come back to you, Sasha.
Sure.
Well, indeed. In fact, this revenue and government capacity to create money are very, very important issues. Firstly, the government goes to borrow money from banks. Banks are licensed to create money. The only institution that has the prerogative to create money is government, first and foremost. Mm. All else are licensed by government. To the extent that government is the only institution with that prerogative, it cannot therefore be the same government that says it doesn't have money. Why should government go and borrow money when it can in fact create money? And that prerogative to create money is its sole prerogative. Therein, the confusion comes in, where we think that, well, the government taxes are the revenue for state. While that may sound true, actually it's not true. It has been drilled into us where we think taxes are revenue for state. But people forget that many, many governments have operated without taxes for many, many years. And even right now, as we speak, so many governments are not using taxes at all. But anyway, perhaps that is outside the point. The true thing is government is the creator of money. It can judiciously create money and use that money to do whatever it is that it's supposed to do, including infrastructure, investment, many, many other things that government is supposed to do can in fact be done without having to resort to, you know, having to borrow money from banks or the capital markets and so on.
Sasha?
Yes, that really is the starting point for me in this regard.
Okay. Sasha, you were making a point?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the fundamental problem is that, you know, austerity measures, cutbacks, are being implemented to address the problematic debt-to-GDP ratio. You know, we know that the debt-to-GDP ratio is not good and it needs to be addressed. But the problem is by implementing austerity measures, you decrease the GDP, so that ratio is going to continue to climb.
We're basically giving ourselves the wrong medicine. So we've diagnosed what the problem is, what the problem potentially could be. But we really giving ourselves the wrong kind of medication for what ails the economy.
Absolutely. You know, I think we have to pay special attention to the difference. You know, we're stating that we have a lot of priorities, and this sounds wonderful, but the realities of what we're implementing are often completely contradictory to what we're stating our priorities are, you know. So there's like this kind of, you know, there's almost like optics in operation, you know. There was a lot of sound bites circulating following the NCBTS. So we were talking about things like caps on economy class flights and freezes on specific salaries. But, I mean, I think that what that picture really ignores is that the majority of cuts are coming from the poor, you know. The poor people are the ones who are going to be disproportionately affected by this. You know, we've got $20.3 billion cuts to provincial transfers and $20.5 billion to local government. And, I mean, that's the level at which service delivery happens. You know, I wanted to pick up on something that Reg was saying in relation to social security, you know, and I think that it's really problematic to see that as handouts, because exactly what we're talking about, when people have money in their hands, they can contribute to the economy, that can stimulate the economy. And even in terms of the public sector wage bill, you know, something like that might sound like quite interesting and quite progressive, but actually there's nothing said about the distribution of salaries within the wage bill. So you have 29,000 state employees earning over 1 million, and then lower salary scale positions remaining unfilled. So there's also something difficult happening there. You know, the case of gender-based violence and femicide is also incredibly shocking. And I think, you know, this is, again, like we hear the stated priority, but there's absolutely nothing in the MTBPS on how the $1.1 billion promised by President Ramaphosa will be raised or allocated. One of the only ways that it's actually addressed, you know, the stated priority, is to say that over the next 3 years, funds are going to be added to the provincial equitable share to combat gender-based violence and femicide. But then we see massive cuts are happening to the provincial equitable share. So there's a completely contradictory logic happening there.
Okay. The impacts of the budget on women in particular is something that I want to cover as sort of like almost a separate topic. So we will get back to that. Power FM listener, you are listening to Power Perspective on Sunday with me, Lindaba. You can give us a call on 0861-987-000. Our Twitter handle is Power FM Power 987, and our show hashtag is hashtag Power Perspective. Just to get back to this, Reg, I'll start with you. So, like we were speaking about the slowdown in the world economy, which is basically a slowdown in aggregate economic growth. It also means greater income and wealth inequality and growing polarization of employment, especially in light of technological advances. Now, this is obviously going to have an impact in South Africa, especially because we are already the world's most unequal society. So with more and more technology coming in and displacing physical jobs, I actually did not see anything in the medium-term policy statement that actually addresses this. Is this going to be a problem? I'm not seeing anything about a social wage for people who are displaced by technology. Is this something that we need to be considering?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Post-industrial revolution, or whatever name it may be called, there's no doubt the effect of technology on the economy or the economies globally is going to be huge as we go forward. Lots of mechanizations are coming through, and many, many people will be losing their jobs. And to the point that governments must begin to plan around how all these people who will be losing their jobs will be sustained over a period of time. Otherwise, we risk revolutions, isn't it?
Mm.
And that we have not been able to see our government begin to plan around how we're going to be managing our economies going forward as a consequence of these rapid changes in technology. South Africa has to be very, very serious about that. Issues of climate change that may be related as well to that, you know, are also important. But indeed, you know, changes, rapid changes, advances in technology are issues that we should have, in fact, began quite a while back, thinking how we're going to have to deal with them. Do we have to charge robots that are going to have to work, for example, levy them and get that money transferred over to people who are going to be laid off? Or many other ideas that would come. That point, I think, is not being discussed for perhaps obvious reasons. Maybe they're political, I think. People do not want to be alarmed that, you know, technology is going to be taking over the jobs. People say, well, technologies have been there and, you know, we haven't seen massive layoffs of people. But the truth is, times are changing. Whether technologies have been there and we haven't seen lots of layoffs, but frankly, there are going to be layoffs. Therefore, some social wage of some sort will be needed.
Pelisa, this social wage is something that actually people in the tech space, so you've got Elon Musk, you've got Bill Gates speaking about it, you've even got Warren Buffett to some extent speaking about the need to offset job losses caused by technological advances and come up with some kind of a social wage. Yet we are in a space where we're talking about job creation. We're not exactly sure how we're going to create those jobs. And government is actually quite self-contradictory in this respect, because they speak about creating jobs, yet they don't pay small businesses. And this leads to a lot of small businesses actually shutting down as a result of government not paying them. So how do we grapple with this going forward, especially seeing that the government seems to be asleep at the wheel in as far as this issue is concerned?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think perhaps let's just trace this thing back a little bit. You know, when South African economy started deindustrializing, right? And one of the key things that an opportunity that was missed was to actually be able to develop a very clear turnaround industrial strategy so that we don't only keep our own industrial capability as a country, but also what we did is that we just moved, you know, with the global economic wave of financialization, when we knew, in fact, that we had a bigger population that was both unskilled and semi-skilled. And I think with the 4IR, we are caught in a conundrum. But there's a point I want to make, though, and I would be interested to hear your views, both Sasha and Rich and yourself as well. I know that there is no consensus among the economy, general broadly, the economists, around the issue of 4IR and its impact, right? Particularly if you are an economy that, in fact, has very low penetration of technology, which we had become after deindustrialization. So in essence, the key issue we must really think about is that before we even talk about the social wage, we must just talk about what type of technology that exists in South Africa that will in fact enable those working class communities who are trapped in unemployment, poverty, and social inequality. Because in essence, if South Africa is able to do that as a country, it's going to be able to actually even assist other countries within the continent, in the African continent. Because also the risk of actually even now, again, going with a wave, you know, everyone else with the app that, when in fact, poor people still spend, you know, 6 hours in a clinic, all right, without assistance, when after they spend 6 hours, they have no access to proper medication, etc., etc. So I do think that we need to integrate the conversation of 4IR within the developmental aspects. That's the first issue. And then the second issue as well, I think we need to think about, it's around for us as well to be part of 4IR, proper 4IR conversation, we need to reactivate our own industrial capabilities. And I'm just going to make a simple example. We've spent so much on the renewable energy in the last 6 to 7 years, right? But I just wanted to show me which factory in South Africa that manufactures, not assembles, just few basic components of the renewable energy. So in essence, is that we need to really manage this thing very well. And I think fundamentally, it will depend on our own economic architecture, because part of it is that if you have funds, and hence I was talking earlier on around the micro, because I think all of us are drawn into macroeconomic issues, and I'm not saying for any other reason they're not important. But it's important that we better understand our own industrial capabilities, because at the heart of us being able to ensure that we create decent jobs, but at the same time, we support small, medium enterprise who would have been a product of participation in the manufacturing value chain. It's linked to our own capabilities. I don't even think that we have the data that is sitting somewhere that sits to look at what type of technology, what are we doing, and how do we support small, medium enterprises to participate with entry or with light and medium technological capabilities.
Phelisa, is it not true, though, quite honestly, that our manufacturing capacity in this country has been decimated by some of the policy choices that government has made? And here in particular, I'm going to actually call the president out on this, because he has gone out on an investment drive ever since he's become president. Yet there is no concerted effort to actually explain to us, even as citizens of this country, exactly where this investment is going to be directed at. So we're going out and we're going to fetch money, and it looks to me like we're fetching speculative money. So we're not necessarily saying we want money to come in and actually be directed at manufacturing. We want you to build X, Y, and Z type of manufacturing capacity. We seemingly going out in the world and we're saying, bring your money to South Africa and make it grow. But we know that that then drives financialization, which has a very negative impact in terms of job creation. So is that not part of our problem, is that we don't have an industrial policy, or we don't have a coherent industrial strategy?
I mean, frankly, you're correct. I mean, it's been decimated. And I think it's because I agree with you around our own liberalization policy that made us even more vulnerable. We've even lost sectors that will be classified as vulnerable and homegrown sectors. But now, if you have a very clear, and I think here, and this is the issue about this debt to GDP ratio in terms of, so when you raise money, and I want to follow my thought process here, when you raise money from the financial market, where do you channel it to? Because if you channel to consumption and social expenditure, right, it means that you're going to sit with negative growth. But fundamentally, when you channel it to industrial development, and part of that industrial development must be linked to the fact that, firstly, you coordinate with sectors and say, this is where we want to be. We've lost market share. For example, let me make an example. We've lost market share in terms of technological development in the mining sector within the region. We used to have a market share of capital equipment of about 86%. But up until 2008-09-ish, it's gone down to almost 36%. I think there are also a lot to do with some of regional economic integration issues. But at the same time, it has to do with the fact that our own capabilities. Now, so where you allocate your capital in the economy is very important as a state, because then in essence, you can always start building up from the bottom. But you don't have to import a toothpick. You import a needle. Let me make a simple example. The steel industry is struggling in South Africa. A lot of foundries have closed down, because what happens is that we just, from a manufacturing perspective, we process most of the goods at first and second stage, and after that we import before it's converted into either intermediate good or into a consumption good, and then it comes back as a fully consumption good.
Okay.
So it means that in that way, there's a huge issue around both from an industrial development strategy, how we allocate resources, how we coordinate factors at a micro level, but at the same time, the type of incentive package that we provide, including the conditions that we impose.
Okay, Sorry, finish your thoughts. I just want to bring Sasha in as well.
Yes, so consistently, if our own policy posture does not have very strong elements around that, we're going to remain a consumption economy with a declined demand in the economy.
And Sasha, what's your take in terms of are we going to be ready to deal with the job bloodbath that's brought on by the fourth industrial revolution? Because I didn't see in the medium-term budget state policy statement anything that seems to indicate that we are au fait with this problem.
You know, I think Paleso is raising the point of the importance of investments in infrastructure and capital, and I just with all of the cuts that we're seeing, that's really not going to be something that happens. You know, I mean, the situation's so bad because we literally have zero social security for people aged between 18 and 59. Mm. You know, so that's a kind of really dire situation in relation to our unemployment levels, you know. And I think that concerns around the fourth industrial revolution, are really around the increase of precarious forms of work. You know, people are pushed into these very precarious forms of work. And we also see that through a lack of addressing you know, the gender dimensions of the economy as well. So those problems are really things that are exacerbated by really strategies that don't improve the situation. I mean, we see, I think, declared underspent funds of $300 million on small business and innovation due
wow.
to delays in rolling out the program. I mean, so we can say that we have certain priorities, but again, when you look at the numbers, I mean, it's really just shocking. And this is, again, for not big industry, but this is for people on the ground who could be stimulating the economy through creating their own kind of businesses. And that would also be addressing the unemployment rate to an extent. Yeah, I mean, the focus in, Treasury is saying that we need to increase public-private partnerships, you know, in order to assist with the provision of service delivery. But, I mean, there's no evidence that giving the private sector a greater role in doing that has benefits that outweigh the cost, you know.
But can I also ask, because I hear people punt to private-public partnerships as the thing, especially mm-hmm. our national treasury, but these partnerships actually tend to be incredibly expensive.
Mm.
And in anywhere in the world, and I'm going to think, because my special interest is in health, anywhere in the world where you've had public-private partnerships in the healthcare mm-hmm. systems, they've actually driven the cost of healthcare and quite substantially and quite rapidly so. So why is it that our national treasury is obsessed with this idea that public partnerships work when in fact they actually, you know, don't provide the services that they should and they're quite exorbitant in terms of their pricing?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it sounds maybe, you know, in this economic speak, which is inaccessible to most people, like some kind of a strategy, you know, and in place of a lack of any strategy, maybe, you know, things start to sound good, you know. But you're right that that's like this consensus around the fact that they don't work. You know, even the World Bank, I think, and this is years ago, 2014, they were saying that public-private partnerships don't work. They actually failed to attract private investment, you know. So, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, private companies are there to make a profit. And, it's, you know, when government is employing private companies to fill in the gaps in service delivery, you're going to be paying so that they can deliver the service but also, you know, make a profit. So it's kind of completely nonsensical to me. You know, we need strategic investments of borrowed funds, I think, in growth-enhancing activities like infrastructure or healthcare investments. You know, that would reduce relative debt levels in the medium term, by increasing productivity, you know. And I'm really glad that you brought up the issue of the health sector. You know, we've got this moment as well to really position ourselves at the forefront of progressive and effective thinking and dealing with inequalities in our society. You know, we've got the proposals for the NHI. But even with the stated priority of the NHI, I think the NCDP has said that, you know, previous estimates for the rollout are no longer affordable, but updated fiscal models estimate about $33 billion needing to be spent a year from 2025-26. You know, if we keep implementing the regressive policies that we are, we're not going to be able to see the NHI succeed. You know, okay. So the stakes are really high in this, and I'm not sure how much longer we have for the discussion, but I do have some suggestions around alternatives to austerity.
Yeah, we've got a caller on the line, and then we'll continue after the top of the hour till about 10:30. Nina from Craig Hall, have you got a question or comment?
Comment. I'm going to try and be very brief. So the first thing is that I appreciate your conversation, and I think one of the big issues is how these much more forward-looking conversations become deeply embedded in the society so that outdated political thinking doesn't command center stage. It's very, very important. For instance, just to jump to this thing about with 4IR robots providing funding for lost jobs and for those who are non-employed. I think it's a very important concept. It has been articulated internationally. It's not a joke. We can't underestimate the fact that 4IR is being implemented now in this country by big business on a large scale. And if anybody listens to Ron's show, they will know that. So it's not coming. It has come. And the issue is, what do you do with automation and how does it become taxed so that, in fact, the unemployed get a benefit rather than they are undermined? The last point is simply one, you know, Zimbabwe apparently has one third of a mineral, I forget the name of the mineral, that is required for IR to go ahead. Now, also this issue of infrastructure development. You know, I've heard suggested on your platforms the concept that infrastructure development shouldn't be nation-bound, but should be, in fact, sub-Saharan-bound. Mm. And that if one was conceptualizing in that way, then one could, I hesitate to say get sort of funding or loans, but get an infrastructure which would allow for that development and could create jobs on the basis of a sub-Saharan Africa conceptualization rather than a national conceptualization. So if there's any sort of addition to that or comment, I'd really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Nina.
Well,
Reg, do you want to take that one on?
Well, that's a great comment from Nina. I think she's quite correct. I think on the issue of infrastructure, there isn't much that we can do on our own, and you must remember we are a region, and we can only function and grow as a region. So cross-border initiatives on infrastructure, very, very important indeed. But I thought we'll perhaps touch on that a bit later. Lee, I wanted quite quickly to I know we're running out of time, to bring back two fundamental issues you yourself raised earlier. All right, the aggregate demand and coherent industrial policy.
Mm.
And therefore link it to what Tito, the Minister of Finance, was talking. You see, the contradictory part is it doesn't matter how much support you give to SMMEs to start new businesses. It just doesn't matter. You can give them billions of rands. And, you know, when these people start, they're not going to export, you must remember. First, they produce for the local market. But the local market has no demand at all.
Mm-hmm.
All right? The very demand that Tito is killing, the aggregate demand in this country is zero. It's going down. Structurally low.
And Rach, can we just take a standstill on that for a second? And I think it's very important for South Africans to understand that inadequate investment in the economy, okay, whether it's local investment or FDI, which I think is quite dangerous, but let me say local inadequate investment in the economy is leading to a shortage in aggregate demand, which is leading to long-term stagnation of the economy. So what we're seeing is as a result of us, and I mean by us, I mean government, not necessarily investing in the right sectors. So in manufacturing, in the sectors of the economy that actually drive demand, which is actually leading to a slowdown. So it's actually bad policy choices that have led us here. Correct?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes. Absolutely. You know, and until we push aggregate demand in this economy, all what we have invested already is going to collapse. You must remember there's two-thirds of the survey managers or CEOs were surveyed say, well, we cannot sell our wares, all right? So there's no demand. So what means even the production that we have is going to go down. So absence of aggregate demand is in fact collapsing the supply itself.
So the fact, so what we are saying is that the fact that this economy is stagnant, the fact that this economy is not growing, is as a direct result of government policy choices led by Treasury.
Absolutely, including the Reserve Bank.
Absolutely. I mean, just a simple example. You know, between the 2006 and 2011. In terms of our spending of in the capital formation and specifically on infrastructure investment, when we spent about 23.6%, and today we're spending less than 2%. I mean, I still have to see what is this infrastructure fund that will be housed at the DBSA, exactly what are they really going to be doing. So when you're starting to trace, and I mean, not that for any other reason, we've seen a lot of growth during those years. But when you're starting to trace about the economic activities and how the government has managed to stimulate the economy, it's completely different. But here's the interesting thing here as well, is that linked with that, there were few other economic variables that were actually, or indicators that were triggered. For instance, you would know the letter that the former minister, Pravin Gordhan, had written to the Central Bank, our Reserve Bank, governor, and saying, can you please focus on growth? So if you trace, for example, the type of interest rate cuts that we've seen there combined with that, we had a completely different situation. But I think what makes things even worse now, and I think the possibility is that that's why our unemployment had really remained between 23% and 26% for a long time, right? But now, because the government has not really been spending on any project that stalled. I mean, I know there was a whole initiative around PICC, which was meant to coordinate infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. So really, exactly.
Pelissa, let's pick up on that when we come back from a quick break. For our listener, 0861-987-000, that is the number to call to join the conversation. Good evening, Power listener. You are listening to Power's Perspective with me, Lee Ndaba. 0861-987-000. That's the number to call to get in with the conversation. And our Twitter handle is Power987. Pelissa, Pelissa and Sasha, we seem to have lost Reg. Mm-hmm. We have Nyaniso on the line from Tembisa. Nyaniso, have you got a question or comment?
Just two quick comment, and perhaps you'll get with something. What I want to check with, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Oh, okay, good enough. What I really want to say is what we are not talking about here, I think it's missing in this discussion, is the contradiction of finance by its very own nature. You would know that capitalism on its own has allowed the rapid increases in price as opposed to production. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, mm-hmm. today we are talking about the financialization of everything. Mm-hmm. Now, when Tito was making that statement, the question we should be asking ourselves is, are the very same political figures or people that we elect are having an edge over a cartel or trust or banks that seems to have taken the very same, what I would call the power struggle or the bargaining power that we as voters have actually given or licensed to politicians, meaning that Tito does no longer have power compared to those cartels that we are currently talking about. The second point that I wanted to touch on is, you know, growth is good, but also growth is good if it's for everyone. We had growth in previous years, but inequalities were still going up. That on its own has resulted in poverty. Where growth is good for everyone is where the state has an ability to intervene from a macro management point of at the level of macro management. And in that way, they are able to make sure that the layoff or the union has got that bargaining power. But today it is not there.
Nyani, so sorry, are you saying that government should intervene at a macro level, a macro with an A, or a micro level, micro with an I?
A.
A.
At the macro level with an A.
So can they not do both though? Because I feel that yes, there are some strategic interventions that we can do at a macro level, but there's also operational interventions that government can do at a micro level to actually direct how the economy grows.
Well, if you do at the macro, at the A, well, the ripple effect is that it's likely to happen at the micro. I'll make an example.
But does it happen on its own, or does government have to actually stimulate that?
That's why I want to give an example.
Mm.
I think you're quick to respond to what I was about to say to you.
Mm.
Let's make an example. Eskom owes suppliers, I think, about 400 billion, if I'm not mistaken. Now, on its own, you know that your tax, I think there was under collection on revenue tax by 50%. You already know that as a treasury, there's a locked-up tax on those suppliers that if you pay them now, they are able to retain the money. They're going to be a set-off between the two. Now, if you are a forward-thinking government, you are able to say, let's prioritize these suppliers so that we are able to get back our tax. In that way, we are able also to generate more jobs that are likely to leverage on the very same a job creation that we are trying to create. But all I'm saying is that if you have that intervention at the macro level, it's where you are able to actually squash cartels. That seems to have taken edge over politics or over policy makers because of this financialization of everything. And if you are not able to deal with that, you can go to micro. But if you are leaving these cartels to do on their own, it's more like we haven't done anything. We've just scratched the surface.
Okay, thank you very much, Nyani. So, Pelisa, I hear you. I think it's you that's like really agreeing with some of what Nyani so was saying.
Yes. No, I mean, I agree with Nyani. I think let me start with the first point. In fact, there's something that I'm quite passionate about. I often say, you know, when I want to retire, I just want to go to villages because life is cheaper there. Because I think when you make comparison between the cost of living, particularly in what I call, you know, provinces that are holding our economy together, right?
Which is so the Western Cape and Gauteng.
Gauteng and a little bit of KZN. And comparatively speaking, when you go outside, I mean, things are completely different. Because, and Yanis is correct, that what the capitalist systems have done is that when they realized that they were losing income or revenue, right, as a result of a shrinking growth, so instead of introducing structural reforms and being innovative, what they did was that they had to push up prices so that they are actually, they don't lose any form of profit. And I think for me, and I think, Lee, I mean, I just want to implore you that perhaps the issue of cost of living in South Africa is just a debate on its own. That is very important. We need to start looking at. Because fundamentally, that's when you're going to start looking at what is this inflation targeting arrangement do we have? Mm. And what basket of goods that it, does it look at? But, I mean, when people, you know, for your black working people are expected to pay for education, for healthcare, for transport, for food, for water, for energy, for house, right? With absolutely no safety net. I think the point that Sasha was making, that people between the age of 18 and 59 have absolutely no social net. If you fall off the system, you completely fall out and you are unable to be supported. So I absolutely agree with Nyanis. I think even though I don't think I agree with him over the government intervention only at a macroeconomic level, I think part of the stagnation we've seen, while at a microeconomic level, this we've had the discussion around beneficiation in the mining sector, in the auto sector, in the steel sector, etc. And these are the sectors that are currently struggling. And part of it is that we're unable to actually fundamentally benefit from the value chain linked with specifically those sectors. Because and exactly the point I was making around lack of microeconomic intervention.
So, Sasha, why is it, as an example, that for as long as I can remember, actually, as long as I've been interested in economics, at least, the government has always spoken about beneficiation and actually adding value to our minerals before they leave the country. But none of that has actually happened. So we're very good at talking about it. We know what it is, but we just can't seem to implement it.
I mean, sorry, so I just want to return and pick up on a couple of things that Palesa was saying. You know, I just want to index the state of you know, the standards of living amongst the actual people, you know. So, you know, the child support got that 420 Rand, that's 23% below the food poverty line, which is the absolute starvation line. You know, there's this measure called the decent standard of living, and this is really modest. It's not excessive, but it's about living a life of basic dignity with access to things like healthcare, transportation, clothing, education. Only 3% of South Africans have that. So it's incredibly dire, and I think that's some of
Sasha, it's very important for us to actually put a number to this. So the living wage in South Africa would be somewhere just over 6,000 Rand a month, right? So something like 6,750 Rand a month, somewhere there, is the actual living wage.
It's quite close to the decent standard of living, which is at 7,326. And I think somewhere around that level is accurate, you know, but then Palesa was also talking about, you know, the increased cost of living. So,
we saw
these massive VAT increases in 2018, and that's actually regressive because it really disproportionately affects the poor, which goes against our constitutional as well as our international obligations. And I think a lot of what the discussion is showing, you know, is that there are very strong opinions and perspectives on what needs to be done. I think we really need to remember that the MTBPS is supposed to be something that is issued for comment, you know. So if we work to make, you know, the implications of the MTBPS more accessible, more people would be open, that would open up the ability to comment to more people whose lives are affected by this. You know, we really need to convince Treasury not to implement the regressive spending plans that they've suggested, you know. I mean, there are alternatives like, you know, we've been talking a bit about the SOEs, which is really necessary because huge chunks of money are going in that direction. You know, and there's the perception that they're too big to fail. You know, if that's the case, there are still alternatives for how to address that situation. You know, the alternative information and alternative information development campaign, AIDC, have suggested looking at the Public Investment Corporation, the PIC, as a creditor, because there you could get, you know, a loan at 0% interest rate.
But if we talk about the PIC, it gets quite dangerous because they've also been accused of funding politicians more than business people. Mm. Is that not true? And is that not what the current PIC inquiry is about?
It's around. Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we've been party to state capture, which actually goes way before the popular conversation about it, you know, all the way back to the kind of arms deal. You know, we have our state institutions being emptied out by this process. And I think that that is something positive that's kind of raised in the MTBPS. It's improving the capacity to SARS, you know, and I think that combating illicit financial flows and tax evasions really need to be an urgent part of South Africa's plans to address some of the debt to GDP ratio. Mm-hmm. So you're right to raise red flags there. You know, I mean, I think that it has been exposed to corruption, as have our other, you know, institutions. Mm-hmm. And we really need to take that seriously. But the point is there's a surplus of a huge amount of money there. So, you know, if we're talking about having to make difficult decisions, again, it comes down to what are the kinds of decisions that we're going to make. And that becomes, to me, a much more appealing, potentially difficult decision than instituting these cuts, which really decimate people's lives and make sure that people aren't able to live lives of basic dignity in this country. I mean, really, that's unforgivable in the context of how much people have had to endure in this country, you know, and all sorts of things happen, like, you know, suicide rates have been shown to massively increase in cases of austerity, you know.
I actually want to speak to that in context of an article that I actually saw earlier today, and that's the impact of austerity on women. Now, we know, as an example, Rach, I'm going to start with you again. We know, as an example, that women access social provisioning in some instances far more than men do. So I'm thinking here about the child care grants, the grant for orphans is overwhelmingly accessed by women more than men. Now, when you start to introduce measures of austerity, the population that you're going to impact on the most is the face of poverty in the country already. So it's black and it's female. In other words, it looks exactly like I do, which scares me endless. So I just need to ask, what is going to be the impact of these austerity measures on, in particular, women?
I'm not a woman, but I know what it is.
Yes. That's why I'm starting with you, Reg. You see, I'm making you very uncomfortable as a man.
it's that we live with women sisters, women mothers, and so on around us, and cousins. Look, the entire framework as it stands, as the way the Treasury is operating it or is conducting it, is unfortunately very much class-oriented and also sexist in a way, because who else benefits if not male, you know, people? Women are going to have to suffer going forward, given all these many, many negative shocks that are being put in fact by the Treasury and indeed government as a whole. We cannot stand by and see our women folk enter into even greater poverty, even greater discrimination, if you want, as a consequence of some of these policies. Well, in fact, I know we are running out of time. I just wanted to reflect further around this particular matter of poverty, especially around women and how both Reserve Bank and Treasury have let us down. Professor Marikani wrote an article I think 2 days ago, and was indicating that there's a declining inflation here. Okay. But it's declining without any positive supply shocks. So what he's saying is that the inflation that we see going down is actually going down because demand is too low. all right? The very issues that cause lots of poverty among women, lots of poverty among people. And it can only be a way, I mean, it can only be resolved by ensuring that both the Reserve Bank and Treasury understand their role, especially when they look at inflation itself. Mm-hmm. Inflation at 4.1 right now requires the Reserve Bank to act, not just to smile that inflation is at 4.1. What they can do, therefore, to save women and the poor is to ensure that there is what we call a high-pressure labor market to absorb as many women as possible in the labor system. That they should be doing because there's no, as of now, there's no pressure from the demand side. And even if we were to employ as many as we could, we won't even push the inflation up to 6%. So indeed, to ensure that austerity is reversed, or the effects of austerity are reversed, the Reserve Bank as well as Treasury must, as a matter of urgency, as part of the solution, ensure that we have what we call a high-pressure labor market. If not, the entire concept of high-pressure economy as soon as possible.
Pelisa, you're the one that actually shared the article on austerity and its impact on women. Is this austerity going to drive women more and more towards transactional relationships? Is this going to drive us more and more into sex work like is happening in England?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, absolutely. In fact, I think Sasha makes the point about precarious forms of work, right? Mm. And I think already women are taking up more than one job a day. So you can imagine that women who are single parent and who have to raise children, is that in fact they rely on either intergenerational support where it exists, but also they rely on community support systems. So in fact, I think we've not even begun to think about whole forms of social impact of austerity measures. Recently, someone was sharing an article about how they were nearly scammed by someone who called and said, hi, you know, some car, you know, some brand, I don't want to mention their name, they are recalling their cars because there was a factory fault in the engine. Please return it, and you don't have to give us the address. We'll come and collect it. And this person was quite vigilant, and he decided, okay, let me just call to check if this is really true. And when they called the company or the dealer, they were told that, oh, no, we don't have such a callback of cars. Mm. Our cars are good. So fundamentally, you can always start to think about what type of small scams that are going to start emerging as a result of people not having access to income already with the history of income inequality as a country, living wage. Our wage in the labor market is 3,000, and actually the real living wage is above 7,000. So you can imagine that people are going to find all sorts of innovative ways of survival. And I think women are just going to be even much more affected, because already given the multiple roles they play, both at the community level and household level, to look after families. I mean, we know, for example, a lot of people, and this was just came up in a research around, firstly, when we had a huge HIV AIDS impact, a lot of women withdraw from labor market to support people who were sick in the family. So that was a loss of income. And most of those women were never able to rejoin the sector. That's, you know, to rejoin labor markets. The second component is that you've seen as well what you call areas of work that were traditionally occupied by women. Currently, you actually find men working in those areas. One of those is restaurants. Now, because restaurants open up until 2 a.m. in the morning, and there's been a lot of gender-based violence in that sector, because women who would leave work at 2 a.m. in the morning without access to transport, they would be exposed to sexual assault, and it meant that they must withdraw from labor market because they felt that their lives were exposed. So we're likely to see a whole lot of things that are really happening around us because we don't pay attention And I think for me, when the minister says, no, our priority is on education, social development and health, but we don't pay attention at the fact that every time we withdraw or we cut budgets, the real people that get affected is the working class community, because you feel more interest in social instability, but at the same time is that women are even more vulnerable.
So these budget cuts, let's be very honest, and let's look South Africa right in the face and tell her the truth, is that these budget cuts are going to see an increase in gender-based violence. Because it's you are putting women who are already incredibly vulnerable, even in a more precarious position and in even more vulnerable position, by actually, cutting government spending in the areas that actually benefit women. So if you're going to cut your national budget, you're going to cut in areas such as policing, as an example, we're not going to see the kind of increase in social grants that we should see, because clearly there's austerity measures. Sasha, what's your take on the impact of these budget cuts on women?
I mean, I raised, vulnerable groups, women and gender non-conforming people being pushed into precarious forms of work. So that's, sex work, but also things like informal trading. And the problem of, being engaged in this precarious work system is that you don't have access to things like medical care and to pensions. I want to speak about this thing called reprioritization, which happens within the MTBPS. So we shift funds around between different votes and different programs. Paletta said, there are these focuses on, education, social development. Actually, there's massive cuts to higher education, despite 430 close million to education housing. Projects, which is completely contradictory when it's cuts to education. Community development has cuts, which include things like housing, water and sanitation and electricity. So in relation to gender-based violence and femicide, although it's stated as a priority area, I think in the AENE, the adjustments of expenditure, of national expenditure, the term gender only comes up 7 times. And what we see with shifts of funds is that 60 million is being taken away from the South African Social Security Agency, and 33 million is being taken away from HIV and AIDS organizations to go into the priority of addressing gender-based violence and femicide. I mean, so these are the only kind of instances where it comes up, how funds will be allocated to that priority.
That's very interesting.
It disproportionately affect women, and gender non-conforming people, vulnerable groups. I mean, to take it from areas that will negatively affect their life is completely contradictory, I mean, it's just absolutely bizarre to me. It makes zero sense, and you think about things as well, like if we're talking about cuts to service delivery at the provincial and municipal levels, that disproportionately affects these groups as well. You think of people like having to walk to unsafe toilets and be exposed to gender-based violence and not being able to access basic services, and it's a scary reality to wrap your head around when we know that the levels of violence are increasing to, exponentially and to incredibly shocking levels. I mean, globally, our levels of gender-based violence and femicide are through the roof. I mean, I think the worst.
We're the worst. So just to end it, we actually kill more women than some war zones. I think we actually have a higher death rate amongst women than countries like Yemen, who are actually in the middle of civil wars, have. And with that, unfortunately, we have run out of time. So I would like to thank Sasha Knox, Phelisa Nkomo, and Reg Nkosi, all of them economists, for joining us tonight as we were discussing the medium-term budget policy statements. Thank you very much all. And up next, we will be discussing broad-based economic empowerment with Khandani Msibi and Kuma Duma.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.